watch her leave, and when she stalked past the window of the restaurant, he busied himself with his drink again. Out of the corner of his eye he saw that she did not look in at him. He worried for a while about her walking home alone, but then stopped himself, recognizing the feeling for guilt over the fight. Hawkspur Green was a hamlet, made ludicrously prosperous by the influx of driver-class professionals and their families. It had crime levels appropriate to a playgroup, nothing beyond occasional vandalism, and even that mostly graffiti tagging. Plus, Carla could look after herself, and the house was barely 15 minutes away. He was just manufacturing excuses to go after her. Fuck that. The pitcher came. He drank it. Chapter 10. Southwest Zone, the Brunt Land. The decaying concrete bones of the estate squatted mostly in darkness. A handful of unsmashed lights cast sporadic stains of sodium orange on walkways and stair stacks. Isolated lit windows stamped the darkened bulk of buildings in black and yellow code. Child-size shadows scurried away from Carla's headlights as she parked the Land Rover. Once outside the protection of the vehicle, it was worse. She could feel professional eyes watching her set the anti-theft systems, professional ears listening to the quick, escalating whine of the contact stunner charging from the battery. She walked as rapidly as she could, without showing fear, away from the vehicle and into the lobby. Miraculously, the elevators appeared to be working. She had stabbed at the button more to vent frustration than anything else, and was almost alarmed when the lights above the battered metal doors blinked and the downward arrow illuminated. She blinked a little herself, wiped angrily at a tear that had leaked out over one eyelid, and waited for the lift to arrive. Her right hand was wrapped tightly around the stun gun Chris had bought for her. There was a can of mace in her left. The lobby at her back was coldly lit by grating protected halogen bulbs and starkly empty, but the wired glass portals she'd come through were cracked and pushed in at a height suggesting kicks, and the damage looked recent. "Fuck you, zectiv cunts," said a wall to her left in daubed red lettering. Pointless rage. No self-respecting executive was going to be seen dead in the Bruntland. The elevator arrived, but when the doors opened, the stench of urine was so thick she gagged. She deliberated for a moment, then compressed her lips and headed for the dimly lit stairwell to her right. Holding the mace hand extended and keeping the stun gun hidden behind her back, she climbed the 5 double flights of stairs and marched down the corridor with steps intended to convey to anyone who might hear her that she was at home in this stinking pit. She stopped at number 57 and hammered on the door with the butt of the mace can. There was a sound of slow, slurred movement inside. A light sprang up under the door.
"Who's there?"
"Dad, it's Carla."
She tried to keep her voice even, partly out of pride, but more out of a desire not to alarm. Only a year ago, her father had told her, one of the local edge gangs on the estate had forced an elderly woman to open her door by holding a gun to her daughter's head on the doorstep. Once in, they'd ransacked the apartment, raped the daughter while her aged mother was forced to watch, and then beaten both women into unconsciousness. Apparently, they hadn't bothered to kill either of their victims. They knew there was no need. The police attitude to the zones was containment, not law enforcement. Raids were infrequent and unrelated to actual crimes committed. The estate was gangwit run. Rape and burglary were not considered transgressions of gang law.
"Carla?"
There was the snap of the lock being unfastened, the solid thunk as the security bolt system she and Chris had paid to have installed was disengaged, and then the door was thrown wide. Her father stood in the doorway, a pool cue hefted in his right hand.
"Carla, what are you doing here at this time of night?"
He switched to Norwegian.
"And where's Chris? You didn't come up here alone, did you? For Christ's sake, Carla!"
"Hello, Dad," she managed.
He ushered her inside, slammed the door shut, and engaged the bolt system again. Only then did he relinquish his grip on the queue, dropping the makeshift weapon into an umbrella stand by the door, and opening his arms to hug her.
"It's good to see you, Carla, even if it is 12:30. What the fuck happened?"
"Oh, don't tell me."
He nodded as the repressed tears began to leak out, and she trembled against him.
"Not another fight. Is he downstairs?"
She shook her head against his shoulder.
"Good. I won't have to be diplomatic, then."
Erik Nyquist stepped back from his daughter a little and took hold of her chin.
"Why don't you come and have a whiskey coffee with me and we can bitch about him in his absence?"
She choked her laugh. He echoed her with a gentle smile.
"That's better," he said.
So they sat in front of an antique electric heater in a threadbare living room with mugs of cheap coffee and cheaper whiskey steaming in their fists, and Erik stared into the reddish glow of the heating element while his daughter talked. The tears were under control now, and Carla's voice was firm, an analytical tool sifting through the settled sediment first of the last few hours, then of the last few weeks, finally of the last few years.
"It's just," she said, "I'm sure we didn't always used to fight this much, did we? You must remember."
"Well, you never drove across the cordon zones in the middle of the night alone because you'd been fighting," Erik admitted. "That's a first, at least. But if I'm honest, I think you've been having arguments with Chris about as long as you've known him to any appreciable depth, certainly as long as you've been married. I couldn't say if you have more now than you used to, but that's not really the point."
Carla looked up, surprised.
"It isn't?"
"No, it isn't. Carla, marriage is an artificial state, invented by the patriarchy to ensure that fathers know who their children are. It's been going on for thousands of years, but that doesn't make it right. Human beings were never designed to live like that."
"I think I've read this somewhere before, Dad."
"The fact that it was written by your mother," Erik said severely, "does not invalidate the argument. We are tribal, not matrimonial."
"Yeah, yeah. Let's see if I remember how it went. The basic human social unit would have been a matriarchal tribe, a female, child-rearing and knowledge-keeping center with a protective outer shell of warrior males. How does it go? Children held in common by the tribe, reproduction only understood by the females, and..."
"The point is, Carla, exclusive pairing is unnatural. Two people were never meant to be so exclusively matched to each other."
"That's a pretty fucking poor excuse," she said, then bit her lip.
Erik gave her a reproachful look.
"That isn't what I meant. Look, even in the recent past you had extended families to soak up some of the strain. Now we live in isolated couples or nuclear families, and either both partners are working so hard they never see each other, or they're not working and the stress of living on the poverty line tears them apart."
"That's a simplification, Dad."
"Is it?"
Erik cradled his mug in both hands and looked back into the red glow from the heater.
"Look at where you live, Carla. A village neither of you knew the name of 3 years ago. No friends living close. No family. Not even a workplace social life unless you're prepared to drive for an hour and a half at the end of the evening. All these things put a huge strain on you both, and fights are the result. The natural result. It wouldn't be natural not to fight with someone you share your whole sleeping and waking life with. It's healthy, it provides release, and if you don't hold grudges, it shouldn't damage the relationship."
Carla shivered despite the heater.
"This is damaging us," she said.
Erik sighed.
"You know what your mother said to me before she went back to Tromsø?"
"Fuck you and that English bitch."
She regretted it as soon as the words left her mouth, surprised that the anger was still there on tap nearly 2 decades later. But Erik only smiled wryly, and if there was pain behind that, it didn't show. She reached across to him with one hand.
"I'm sorry."
"Don't be." The smile flickered but held. "You're right. She did say that. More than once. But she also said that it was high time.
that she wasn't really surprised because we didn't have fun together any more. She said that. We have no fun any more, Eric.
Oh, come on.
No, she was right, Carla. He looked across at her, and this time there was pain in his face. Your mother was usually right about these things. I was always too busy being political and angry to spot the emotional truths. She hit the nail on the head. We didn't have fun any more. We hadn't had any real fun for years. That's why I ended up with Karen in the first place. She was fun, and that was something your mother and I'd stopped trying to do years ago.
Chris and I still have fun, Carla said quickly.
Eric Nyquist looked at his daughter and sighed again.
Then you hold on to him, he said, because if that's true, if it's really true, then what you've got is worth any amount of fights.
Carla shot him a surprised glance, caught by the sudden gust of emotion in his voice.
I thought you didn't like Chris.
Eric chuckled.
I don't, he said. What's that got to do with it? I'm not sleeping with him.
She smiled wanly and went back to watching the heater.
I don't know, Dad. It's just...
He waited while she assembled her feelings into a coherent shape.
Just since he went to work at Shawn.
She shook her head wearily.
It doesn't make any sense, Dad. He's making more money than he ever has. The hours aren't so different from what he used to clock at Hammett McCall. Fuck it, we ought to be happy. We've got all the props for it. Why are we falling out more now?
Shawn Associates. And is he still in emerging markets?
She shook her head.
Conflict investment.
Conflict investment.
Eric smacked his lips against his teeth, then got up and went to the bookcase set against the wall opposite the heater. He dragged a finger across the tightly packed spines of the books on a lower shelf, found what he was looking for, and tugged the volume out. Flicking through the pages, he came back to the heater and handed it to her.
Read that, he said. That page.
She looked at the book, turned it to see the title.
The Socialist Legacy, Miguel Benito. Dad, I'm not in the mood. This isn't about politics.
Everything is about politics, Carla. Politics is everything. Everything in human society, anyway. Just read the passage in highlighter.
She sighed and set down her coffee mug at her feet. Clearing her throat, she picked up the line with one finger and read aloud.
Revolutionaries throughout the 20th century had always been aware?
Yes, that one.
Revolutionaries throughout the 20th century had always been aware that in order to bring about a convulsive political change...
Actually, I meant read it to yourself.
She ignored him, ploughing on with the edge of sing-song emerging in her voice.
In order to bring about a convulsive political change, it was essential to intensify the existing social tensions to the point where all would be driven to choose sides in what would thus be established as a simplistic equation of class conflict. Marxists and their ideological inheritors described this as sharpening the contradictions of society. In populist Dad, is there a point somewhere in all this bullshit?
Just finish it, will you?
She pulled a glum face.
In populist recognition of this underlying truth, the cry during the latter half of the last century became, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Ah, new paragraph. What any survivor of late Marxist ideology would be forced to recognize in the politics of the 21st century is that the contradictions are now so heavily disguised that it would be the work of decades simply to reveal them, let alone sharpen them into anything resembling a point. A bit like their prose style, huh? All right, nearly there. An overall problem is now no longer perceived, therefore an overall solution no longer sought. Any distasteful elements within the world economic order are now considered either candidates for longer-term fine-tuning, or worse still, an irrevocable byproduct of economic laws supposedly as set in stone as the laws of quantum physics. So long as this is believed by the vast majority of the populace in the developed world, the contradictions identified by Marxism will remain hidden, and each individual member of society will be left to resolve for themselves the vaguely felt tensions at an internal level. Any effort to externalize this unease will be disdained by the prevailing political climate as discredited socialist utopianism, or simply, as was seen in Chapter 3, the politics of envy.
She laid down the book.
Yeah. So what?
That's your problem, Carla.
Eric had not sat down while she was reading. He stood with his back to the heater and looked down at her as if she were one of his students. She felt suddenly 15 years old again.
Unresolved contradictions. Chris may still be the man you married, but he's also a soldier for the new economic order, a corporate samurai, if you want to adopt their own imagery.
I know that, Dad. That's nothing new. I know what he does. I know how his world works. I help build and repair the vehicles they used to kill each other, in case you'd forgotten. I'm just as involved in it all, Dad. What?
He was shaking his head. He crouched to her level and took both her hands gently in his own.
Carla, this isn't about you and Chris. It's barely about you at all. Benito's talking about internal contradictions, living with what you are, with what your society is. At Hammett McCall, Chris could do that, because there was a thin veneer of respectability over it all. At Sean, there isn't.
Oh, bullshit! You've read what these people are like. Dad, you used to write about what they were like, back when there was anyone with the guts to publish it.
The only difference between conflict investment and emerging markets is the level of risk. In emerging markets, they don't like conflict or instability. The guys in CI thrive on it. But it's the same principle.
Eric smiled and let go of her hands. That sounds to me like Chris talking. And he's probably even right, but that's not the point.
You keep saying that, Dad.
Eric shrugged and seated himself again.
That's because you keep missing it, Carla. You think this is about a rift between you and Chris, and I'm telling you it's not. It's about a rift inside Chris. Now you're saying there's no difference between what he used to do and what he's doing now, and aside from a few semantic quibbles, that may be true. But Chris hasn't just changed what he does. He's changed where he does it, and who he does it for, and that's what counts. Along with Nakamura and Lloyd Paul, Sean Associates is the most aggressive player in the investment field. That applies to their arbitrage and emerging markets divisions just as much as conflict investment. They're the original hard-faced firm. No gloss, no moral rationalizations. They do what they do. They're the best at it. That's what they sell on. You go to Sean because they're mean motherfuckers and they'll make money for you come hell or high water. Fuck ethical investment. Just give me a fat fucking return and don't tell me too much about how you got it.
You're making speeches, Dad.
There was a taut silence. Carla stared into the heater, wondering why she found it so easy to sink these barbs into her father. Then Eric Nyquist chuckled and nodded.
You're right. I am, he said cheerfully. Sorry about that. I miss seeing myself in print so much, it all just balls up inside me. Comes out whenever I have someone to talk to.
I don't mind, she said distantly. I just wish...
Wish what?
She had a vivid flash of recall, toothpaste white. She would have been about 6 or 7 at the time, staying with grandparents in Tromsø, and cocooned in the cold outside, warm inside security the visits there always brought. She remembered Eric and Kirsty Nyquist on skis, propped against each other for support on the hill behind Kirsty's parents' house, and laughing into each other's faces, having fun in the definitive Nyquist fashion that she, as a child, had always imagined would characterize her future married life, the way it would always characterize her parents. The flash faded into the dull red glow of the electric heater. She reached for her father's hand.
Nothing.
Chapter 11.
Drink?
Mike Bryant shook his head. Still dealing with the hangover, thanks, Louise.
Just water if you've got it.
Of course. Louise Hewitt closed the steel-paneled door of the office drinks cabinet and hefted a blue 2-liter bottle from the table beside it instead. Sit down, Mike. Drinking, or whatever, midweek, that can be a pretty lethal mistake.
Not lethal, said Brian, massaging his temples a little as he sank onto the sofa. But definitely a mistake at my age.
Yeah, must be hell being 34. I remember it vaguely. Hewitt poured water into 2 glasses and sat on the edge of the sofa opposite. She looked at him speculatively. Well, I won't toast you with water, but congratulations do seem to be in order. I just got off the phone to Bangkok. That sketch on Cambodia you dropped last time you were out there finally landed on the right gorilla head.
Bryant sat up straighter and forgot his hangover.
Cambodia? The smack war thing?
Hewitt nodded.
The smack war thing, as you so elegantly define it. We've got a guerrilla coalition leader willing to deal. Q. Sari. Sound familiar?
Bryant drank from his water glass and nodded.
Yeah, I remember him. Arrogant motherfucker. Had ancestors in the original Khmer Rouge or something.
Yeah.
There was the slightest hint of mockery in Hewitt's echo of the grunted syllable.
Well, it looks like this Sari needs arms and cash to hold the coalition together. The Cambodian government's on the edge of offering an amnesty to any of the heroin rebels who want to come in and disarm. If that happens, the coalition's gone and Sari loses his power base. But if he can hang on, our sources in Bangkok reckon he's in line to march on Phnom Penh inside 2 years.
Optimistic.
Local agents always are. You know how it is. They pitch rosy so you'll bite. But this guy's been on the money in the past. I'm inclined to go with it, so you'd better break out your copy of Reed and Mason, because this one's yours, Mike.
Mike Bryant's eyes widened.
Mine?
All yours, Hewitt shrugged. You made it happen. You've got the executive experience to cover it. Like I said, congratulations.
Thanks.
The proposal is not uncontested, Hewitt said casually.
Bryant grinned.
What a surprise. Nakamura?
Nakamura and Acropolitik both. Nakamura must have parallel information on Sari. They're offering him essentially the same deal you put together in Bangkok, and the bastard's smart enough to know that forcing us all to tender will bring the prices down.
And Acro?
They've got the status quo mandate. Official economic advisers to the Cambodian regime. They're in it to squash the proposal before it gets off the ground. It's all already cleared with trade and finance.
What's the ground?
North. 300-kilometer dual envelope, contracts to be signed in Conference Auditorium 6 at the Tebbit Center. Turn up with blood on your wheels or don't turn up. The word is Nakamura have pulled Mitsua Jones for this one. Flying her in to head up the UK team. Acropolitik don't have anyone in her league, but they'll no doubt be sending their finest. Against all of that, you get a team of 3, including you. Suggestions?
Nick Makin, Chris Faulkner.
There was no hesitation in Bryant's voice.
Hewitt looked dubious. Your chess pal, huh?
He's good.
You don't let personal feelings get in the way of professional judgment around here, Mike. You know that. It's bad for business.
That's right. I know that. And I want Faulkner. You said this was mine, Louise. If you don't...
Makin doesn't like Faulkner, Hewitt said sharply.
Makin doesn't like anyone. That's his secret. The problem here, Louise, is that you don't like Faulkner. And it isn't much of a secret either.
May I remind you that you're speaking to the executive partner of this division?
Hewitt's voice stayed level, just a shade cooler all of a sudden. She poured herself more water while she talked.
For your information, Mike, personal feelings have nothing to do with this. I don't think Faulkner is up to a tender of this magnitude. I also think that you're letting a friendship cloud your professional judgment, and I'm going on record with that. This is going to go badly wrong if you're not careful.
Louise, this is going to go like a dream,
Bryant grinned wolfishly.
Makin and Faulkner are both proven hard men on the road, and as far as I'm concerned, that's the bottom line. We don't have anybody better, and you know it.
There was a pause in which the loudest sound was Louise Hewitt swallowing water. Finally she shrugged.
All right, Mike, it's your call. But I'm still going on record against it, and that makes Faulkner 100% your responsibility. If he fucks up...
If he fucks up, Louise, you can fire him, and I'll hold the door open.
Bryant flashed the grin again.
Or the window.
Hewitt took a disc out of her pocket and tossed it onto the table between them.
If he fucks up, you'll all be dead, she said shortly, and Sean'll be out of a medium-term CI contract worth billions. That's the briefing. Route blow-ups, road surface commentaries. Make sure they both get copies. Make sure Faulkner understands what he's got to do. Blood on the wheels, Mike, or there's no deal.
I remember a time, Bryant let just a hint of his American burlesque tinge the words. Used to be enough just to get there first.
Hewitt smiled despite herself.
Bullshit, you do. You just heard Notley and the others talk about it. And even they barely remember when it was that cuddly. Now get out of here and don't disappoint me.
Wouldn't dream of it.
Bryant picked up the disc and got up to go. At the door he paused and looked back to where she was still sitting at the desk, sipping her water.
Louise?
Yes?
Thanks for giving me this.
Don't mention it. Like I said, don't let me down.
No, I won't.
Bryant hesitated, then took the plunge.
You know, Louise, you go on record against Faulkner now, and you run the risk of looking very silly when he works out.
Hewitt gave him an icy, executive partner smile.
I'll run that risk, thank you, Michael. Now, was there any other advice you'd like to give me on running the division?
Bryant shook his head wordlessly and left. He stopped by Chris's office and found the other man standing at the window, staring out at the hail. Winter was hanging on unseasonably long in London, and the skies had been gusting fistfuls of the stuff for weeks.
"What's happening?" he asked as he stuck his head around the door.
Chris jerked visibly as Bryant spoke. Clearly he'd been a long way off. Coming across the office to the window, Bryant was hard put to see anywhere visibly more attractive than the 53rd floor of the Shawn Tower, and was forced to conclude that Chris had been daydreaming.
"Mike."
Chris turned away from the view to face his visitor. His eyes were red-rimmed and angry with something not in the immediate vicinity. Bryant backed up a step.
"Whoa, Chris, you've got to lay off the crystal edge."
It was only half a joke, he admitted to himself. Chris looked like shit.
"Remember Rancid Nagin? Just say no, not till the weekend."
Chris smiled, a forced bending of the lips as he rolled out the time-honored Dex and Seth comeback.
"Hey, I don't do that shit no more."
"What, weekends?"
Reluctantly, the smile became a grin.
"You come up with a move or what?"
"Not yet. But don't worry, the turnaround is in sight."
This time they both grinned. The match, currently their fifth, was well into the end game, and barring a brain hemorrhage, Chris couldn't lose. Which would make it 4-1 against Bryant, a score that the big man didn't seem to mind as much as Chris had thought he might. Bryant played a flamboyant, queen-centered game, and when Chris inevitably worked out a fork and took that piece away from him, Bryant's strategy usually went to pieces. Chris's cautious, defensive earthworks stood him in good stead every time, and Bryant continued to be perplexed when his assaults broke on the battlements of pawns, while a pair or a trio of innocuous pieces chased his exposed king around the board and pinned it to an ignominious checkmate. But he was learning, and seemed content to pay the price of that process in defeats. His calls on weekends came far faster than they had in the beginning, and Chris was taking longer to respond each time. This last match had, at more than 2 weeks, already lasted twice as long as the preceding games. Chris thought it might be time to go up in the loft and bring down some of the battered strategy books his father's brother had given him as a child. He needed to sand off the rust if he was going to hold his lead. Maybe, in return, Mike was teaching him to shoot. They were down at the Shawn Armory a couple of times a week now, firing off Nemex rounds at the hollow targets, until Chris's gun hand was numb with the repeated kick of the big weapon. To his own surprise, he was turning out to have some natural aptitude. He hit things more often than he missed, and if he didn't yet have Mike's casual precision with the Nemex, he was certainly making, in the midst of the crashing thunder on the firing range, a quiet kind of progress. He wasn't sure how he felt about that.
"Got something for you," said Bryant, producing the briefing disc from his pocket with a conjurer's flourish.
He held it up between index and ring fingers. The light caught it and opened up a rainbow-sheened wedge on the bright silver circle. Chris looked at the colours curiously.
"And that is?"
"Work, my friend, and this season's shot at the big time. TV fame, as many drive-site groupers as you can handle."
Chris ran the disc at home.
"Look it over," Bryant told him. "Kick back and relax, take off your tie and shoes, pour yourself a shot of that iodine-flavoured shit you drink, and just let it wash over you. I'm not looking for feedback for at least 48 hours.
"Why can't I just run it now?" Chris wanted to know.
"Because," leaning closer with a secret of my success air, "that way you're keyed up with anticipation, and you eat it up at a deeper level. Your brain really sucks it in, just like the 48-hour wait after gives it time to really stew, and by the time we meet to talk about it, you're ready to boil over with insight."
He winked conspiratorially. "Old consultancy trick from way back."
"This just you and me?"
Bryant shook his head. "3-man team. You, me, Nick Macon."
"Oh."
"Is there a problem with that?" Bryant's eyes narrowed. "Something I should know about?"
"No, no."
Watching the closing sequences of the briefing disc, he turned it over in his head and tried to work out why he did feel there was a problem with Nick Macon. Macon hadn't exactly come across as friendly. But neither had Hewitt, or Hamilton for that matter, and a lot of Shawn execs had probably heard the story of Elysia Bennett and Chris Faulkner's sentiment attack. The disc ended with the Shawn Associates logo engraved into a metallic finish on the screen, then clicked off. Chris shelved his thoughts, picked up his drink, and went to look for his wife. He thought for a moment she'd gone to bed with a book, but as he passed the kitchen, he saw that the connecting door to the garage was open and the lights were on. Led by the clinking sounds of tools, he walked through and around the bulk of the Saab, which was jacked up on one side. Carlo's coverall-clad legs and hips protruded from under the car beside an unrolled oilskin cloth full of wrenches. As he watched, she must have stretched out to one side or something, because the angle of her hips shifted and the plane of her stomach changed shape beneath the coveralls. He felt the customary twinge of arousal that her more sinuous movements still fired through him.
"Hey!" He kicked one of her feet. "What are you doing?"
She stayed beneath the car.
"What does it look like I'm doing? I'm checking your undercarriage."
"I thought you'd gone to bed."
There was no response other than the creak of something metallic being tightened.
"I said I thought you'd gone to bed."
"Yeah, I heard you."
"Oh. You just didn't think it was worth answering me."
From the stillness, he knew she had stopped work. He didn't hear the sigh, but he could have cued it, accurate to milliseconds.
"Chris, you're looking at my legs. Obviously, I haven't gone to bed."
"Just making conversation."
"Well, it's not the most engaging conversational gambit I've ever heard, Chris. I'm sorry I didn't pick up on it." "Jesus! Carla, sometimes you can be so—"
Anger and dismay at the idea of having a fight with his wife's feet gave ground in a single jolt to mirth. It was such a ludicrous image that he suddenly found himself smirking and trying to stifle a snort of laughter. She heard it and slid out from under the car, as if spring-loaded there. One hand knuckled across her nose and left streaks of grease.
"What's so funny?"
For some reason, the irritation in her voice, combined with her rapid ejection from under the car and the grease on her nose, drove the final nail into the coffin of Chris's seriousness. He began to cackle uncontrollably. Carla sat up and watched curiously as he leaned back on the wall and laughed.
"I said, what's so—"
Chris slid down the wall spluttering. Carla gave up as a reflexive smile fought its way onto her face.
"What?"
she asked more softly.
"It was just—"
Chris was forcing the words out between giggles and snorts.
"Just your legs, you know."
"Something funny about my legs?"
Well, your feet, really.
Chris put down his glass and wiped at his eyes.
I just...
He shook his head and waved a hand with minimal descriptive effect.
Just thought it was funny. Talking to them, you know. Your feet.
He snorted again.
It's... doesn't matter.
She got up from the floor with an accustomed flexing motion and went to crouch beside him. Turning her hand to present the ungrimed back, she brushed it against his cheek.
Chris. Let's go to bed, he said suddenly.
She held up her hands. I've got to wash up. In fact, I need a shower.
I'll come with you.
In the shower, he stood behind her and ran soaped hands over her breasts, down across her belly, and into the V of her thighs. She chuckled deep in her throat and reached back for his erection, hands still gritty with the last of the engine grime. For a while it was enough to lean in the corner of the shower stall together, locked in an unhurried kiss, rubbing at each other languidly in the steam and pummeling jets of hot water. When the last of the dirt and soap had cascaded off them and swirled away, Carla swung herself up and braced her upper body in the corner while her thighs gripped Chris around the waist and her hips ground against his. It was an inconclusive coupling, so Chris shut off the water and staggered with Carla's arms and thighs still locked around him into the bedroom, where they collapsed, giggling onto the bed, and set about running through every posture in the manual. Later, they lay on soaked sheets, with their limbs hooked around each other and faces angled together. Moonlight fell in through the window and whitened the bed.
"Don't go," she said suddenly.
"Go?" Chris looked down in puzzlement. He had slid out of her some time ago.
"I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying here in this bed with you. Forever."
"Forever?"
"Well, till about 7:30 anyway."
"I'm serious, Chris."
She lifted herself to look into his face.
"Don't go on this Cambodia thing. Not up against Nakamura."
"Carla."
It was almost a reprimand, the way he said it.
"We've been over this before."
"It's my job. We don't have any choice. There's the house, the cards. How are we going to cover those things if I'm not driving?" "I know you've got to drive, Chris, but at Hammett McCall—"
"It's not the same, Carla. At HM I already had my rep. I've got to carve it out all over again at Sean, or some snot-nosed junior analyst is going to call me out, and once that starts, you're watching your tail forever. If they think you're easing up, going soft, they're on you like fucking vultures. The only way to beat that is to stay hard and keep them scared. That way you make partner, and from then on it's a Sunday afternoon spin. They can't touch you. No one below partner status is allowed to call you out."
A vague disquiet passed over him as he remembered what Bryant had told him about Louise Hewitt and the partner called Paige.
"And partner challenges are few and far between. You see them coming, you can negotiate. It's more civilized at that level."
"Civilized?" "You know what I mean."
Carla was silent for a while, then she rolled away from him and huddled herself into the pillow.
"The disc says Nakamura are going to send Mitsui Jones."
Chris shifted a little and tucked in behind her.
"Yes, probably. But if you'd stayed to watch the rest of it, you would have seen that Jones hasn't dueled in the last 6 months. And it won't be her home turf. There's a good chance they won't even use her because of that. Not knowing the road can get you killed a lot faster than going up against a better driver. And anyway, driving on the same team as Mike Bryant and this other guy Macon, I've got nothing to worry about, really."
Carla shivered.
"I saw a profile of Jones a couple of years ago. They say she's never lost a tender."
"Neither have I. Neither has Bryant, as far as I know."
"Yes, but she's driven more than 24 challenges, and she's only 28. I saw her interviewed, and she looks scary, Chris, really scary."
Chris laughed gently against the skin at the nape of Carla's neck.
"That's just camera work. In the States, she's done centerfolds for Penthouse Online. Pouting lips the works. She's a fucking pin-up, Carla. It's all hype."
For a moment, he almost believed it himself.
"When is it?"
she asked quietly.
"Wednesday next week. Dawn start. I've got a sleepover at the office Tuesday night. You want to come in and stay in the hospitality suites with me?"
"No. I'll go across to Dad's."
You could always ask him to come and stay here for a change.
Chris frowned and nuzzled at her back. You know I don't like the thought of you sleeping in that shithole. I worry about you. Carla turned around to face him again. It was hard to tell which was uppermost in her expression, affection or exasperation.
You worry about me? Chris, listen to yourself, will you? Next Wednesday you're out on the road dueling, and you're worried about me sleeping in some substandard housing? Come on.
There's been a lot of violence on that estate, Chris said doggedly. If I had my way...
He stopped, not entirely sure what he wanted to say next.
You'd what?
He shook his head.
Doesn't matter. Forget it. I just think, why can't Eric come and stay here with us for a change?
You know why.
Chris sighed.
Yeah, because I'm a fucking suited parasite on the lives of honest working men and women.
Got it in one. Carla kissed him. Come on, I'll be all right. You just worry about keeping my spaced armor intact. If you come back with the wings all chewed up like last time, you really will see some violence.
Oh, yeah?
She jabbed him in the ribs.
Oh, yeah, I didn't put in all that work to have you broadside and stick like a fucking no-namer. You drive like it matters what happens to your wheels, or that'll be the last blowjob you see this year.
Have to go to my usual supplier, then.
Ow! Fucking piece of shit. Usual supplier, did you say? Who else are you getting blowjobs from, you piece of... Blowtorch! I thought you said blowtorch!
Their mingled laughter penetrated the glass of the window, and sounded faintly in the still of the garden beyond. Had Eric Nyquist been there in the darkness, he would have been forced to admit that what he could hear was, indisputably, the sound of his daughter and the man she had married, having fun. He might even have been glad to hear it. Unfortunately, Eric Nyquist was nearly 100 kilometers southwest of the laughter, listening instead through paper-thin walls to the sounds of an edge dealer beating his girlfriend to pulp. In the garden, the only witness to the noise of Chris and Carla's hilarity was a large, tawny owl that watched the window unwinkingly for a moment, and then turned its attention back to the more pressing matter of disemboweling the half-dead field mouse in its talons. Chapter 12. Apparently it was a long-standing Shawn tradition to do final briefings down among the variously stripped and jacked-up bodies of the company workshops. Chris could see where the custom originated. Nominally, it gave the executives the opportunity to do some corporate bonding with the mechanics overseeing their final vehicle checks. Far more important, the scattered flare of welding torches and the stink of scorched metal put the hard edge of reality on what might have otherwise seemed very far removed from the air-conditioned civility of a more conventional briefing room. In Shawn parlance, it avoided any potential ambiguity. Accordingly, Hewitt kept it brutally short. Keep it tight, don't fuck up. Come back with a contract. Leave the others in pieces on the road. She thanked the chief mechanic personally for his team's hard work and walked away. After she'd gone, Bryant went for Indian takeout and Chris sat in the open passenger door of the Saab, leafing absently through the background printout on Mitsui Jones, while two mechanics in logo-flashed company coveralls strove in vain to find anything worth doing to the engine that Carla had not already done.
"Chris?"
It was Bryant, somewhere off amid the clang and crackle of the body shop.
"Chris, where are you?"
"Around here." There was the sound of stumbling, a clatter and cursing. Chris repressed a grin and did not look up from the printout. 10 seconds later, Bryant appeared around the opened hood of the Saab, cartons of take-out food in his arms and a huge naan bread jammed into his mouth. He seated himself, without ceremony, on a pile of worn tires opposite Chris, and started laying out the food. He took the naan bread out of his mouth and gestured with it toward two of the cartons.
"That's yours. Onion bhaji and danzak. That's the mango chutney. Where'd making go?"
Chris shrugged.
"Toilet? He looked pretty constipated." "Nah, making always looks like that. Anal retentive."
A shadow fell across the food cartons and Bryant looked up, biting on the naan again. He talked through the mouthful.
"Nick, your tikka's in there. Rice there. Spoons."
Makin seated himself with a wary glance at Chris.
"Thanks, Michael."
There was silence for a while, broken only by the sounds of chewing. Bryant ate as if ravenous and finished first. He cast glances at both men.
"Make your wills."
"Why? I'm not going to die." Makin looked across at Chris. "Are you?"
Chris shrugged and wiped his fingers, still chewing.
"See how I feel."
Bryant coughed laughter. Makin allowed himself a small, precise smile.
"Very good. It's good to have a sense of humor. I hear they are big on it at HM. Must make losing more bearable."
"Yeah," Chris smiled gently back. "It can make winning pretty radical, too. You should try it."
Makin tensed. His glasses gleamed in the overhead arc light.
"Does the way I speak amuse you?"
"Not really." "Hey, you guys," Bryant protested. "Come on."
"You know, Chris,"
Makin looked down at his open right hand, as if considering using it as a fist,
"I'm not a chess player. Not much of a game player at all. Oh, I know you like symbolism, games, humor, all good ways of avoiding confrontation."
He tossed his fork into the cooling sauces of Chris's carton.
"But tomorrow is a confrontation. You can't laugh it away. You can't turn it into a game. Mitsui Jones won't play chess with you. She'll hit you with everything she's got, and she'll hit you fast."
On the last word he clapped his hands violently, and his eyes pinned Chris from behind the rectangular paned screens of his glasses.
"There'll be no time to consider your moves out there. You must see it coming," he snapped his fingers, "and act. Nothing else."
Chris nodded and looked down at his food for a moment. Then his hand whiplashed out and snatched Makin's glasses from his nose.
"I think I see what you mean," he said brightly.
"Chris," there was a warning in Mike Bryant's voice. Without his glasses, Makin looked a lot less sharkish, for all his clear lack of vision defects. The narrowly watchful face now looked simply thin. When he spoke, his voice had gone thick and slow with rage, but there was nothing to back it up.
"Michael, I don't think I want to drive with this clown."
Chris held out his hand.
"Would you like your glasses back?"
he asked innocently. Oddly, it was Bryant who snapped.
"All right, you two, that's enough. Nick, you asked for that, so don't act so fucking superior. And Chris, give him back his glasses. Jesus, I'm going up against Nakamura with a pair of fucking kids."
"Michael, I don't think..."
"No, you didn't think, Nick. You just opened your fucking mouth. Louise asked me to head up this team. When she asks you, you can pick who drives with you. Until then, just get in line and keep a lid on it."
The small circle of space between the three men rocked with silent tension. Behind them, the two mechanics looking over the Saab had stopped what they were doing to watch the action. Nick Makin drew in a compressed breath, then took his glasses back without a word and stalked away. Bryant prodded at the food cartons for a while. Finally, he glanced up and met Chris's gaze.
"Don't pay any attention to him. He'll have calmed down by morning."
He brooded a little.
"I think this chess thing might be backfiring. Symbolic conflict isn't what you'd call a popular concept around here."
"What, no game playing? Come on, you're winding me up."
"Yeah, there's games, sure. Some of the other Shawn guys I know are into those Alliance games on the net. The Alpha Mesh Leagues, stuff like that. But chess?"
Bryant shook his head.
"Just not cool, man. Makin isn't the first to mention it. I don't think it'll be catching on."
Chris picked an onion bhajie out of a carton and bit into it reflectively.
"Yeah, well. Always happens when you challenge someone's worldview. Means they have to reevaluate. Most people don't like to think that hard."
Bryant forced a chuckle that loosened up audibly as he produced it.
"Yeah, me included. Still, Makin should know better. No way you start this shit at a time like this."
"Going to be bloody tomorrow, huh?"
"You heard of Jones?"
"Me and the rest of the Western world, yeah."
Bryant looked at him.
"There's your answer, then."
"Well,
Chris tossed the half-eaten bargee back into the carton. I always wondered what the big bonuses were for.
You keep your mind on that bonus tomorrow, Bryant said, grinning, regaining some of his good cheer. And everything will work out just fine. You'll see. Easy money.
The Acropolitic car caught the median barrier head-on, flipped effortlessly into the air and came down on its back, wheels still spinning. A figure slumped, broken and still within. Chris, who'd been expecting a prolonged dogfight with the other car, whooped and slammed a fist against the roof of his own vehicle as he swept past.
"Acropolitic, thank you, and good night."
"Nice," said Mike Bryant's voice over the intercom. "Now form up and stay tight. Those guys were in pristine condition, which to my way of thinking means Nakamura aren't on this stretch."
"Conforming," Nick Macon said crisply. Chris smirked, raised his eyes to the roof and, saying nothing, tucked into the wedge behind Mike. Behind them, the wrecks of the Acropolitic team lay strewn across 3 kilometers of highway like the abandoned toys of a child with emerging sociopathic tendencies. 2 of them were burning.
"Conforming!"
Chris wasn't the only one smirking at Macon's fighter pilot pretensions. 30 kilometers up ahead, Mitsui Jones grinned disbelievingly as the voice crackled out of her car radio. She grasped the edge of her open door and hinged herself out of the Mitsubishi K-gun. The wind came and battered at her $200 Carol Mann tumbling spike cut. Oh, well. The face beneath the jagged hair was pin-up perfect, tanned from a month on the Mexican Pacific coast and made up to accent her Japanese heritage. In keeping with Nakamura dual tradition, she went formally suited, a black Daisuke Todoroki ensemble, whose sole concession to the driving was the flared and carefully vented skirt. There were flat-heeled leather boots on her feet, sheer black tights on her legs.
"Looking good, Mitz?"
She cranked around in the direction of the shout. Behind the long, sunken lines of the K-gun, her colleague's own shorter, blunter Mitsubishi cruisers were parked with raked precision along the overgrown curve of the intersection roundabout. The 2 Nakamura wedge men were cutting up lines of edge on the sleek black hood of the closest car. One of them waved at her. Jones pulled a face and turned to the motorway bridge railing on the other side of the road. Beyond the bridge, the green of the landscape rose in a series of granite-flecked interlocking spurs that blocked out the view of the road at about 5 kilometers distance. She crossed the road and prodded at the feet of the 4th Nakamura team member, who sat with his back to the rails, checking the load on his Vickers Cat shoulder launcher. He glanced up as Jones kicked him and grinned in his beard.
"Ready to rock and roll,"
it came out, surfer drawled. His English, like hers, was West Coast American. The association ran back a couple of years. He nodded across at the other 2 men and their edge ritual.
"You cool with that?"
Jones shrugged.
"Whatever works. New York says they're the best we've got around here, and they should know."
"They should." The missileer laid his weapon aside and got up. Standing, he was a giant, towering over Jones's diminutive frame.
"So, what's the disposition?"
"Acropolitic are out of the game." Jones leaned on the bridge rail. "Shorn did the shit work for us, just like we figured. All we have to do is sweep them up." The missileer leaned beside her.
"Are you sure this is going to work?"
"It worked in Denver, didn't it?"
"It was new in Denver."
"On this side of the Atlantic it's still new. Total press blackout until U.S. trade and finance thrash out the precedent."
A cold smile.
"Which, I'm reliably informed by our government liaison unit, is going to take the rest of the year. The report won't be out till next spring. These guys aren't going to know what hit them."
"It could still be disallowed."
"No." She seemed lost in the southward perspectives of the road below them. "I had the legal boys check the rulings back as far as they go. No discharge of projectile weaponry from a moving vehicle, no substantial destruction to be inflicted with a projectile weapon. We'll get through the same loophole we used in Colorado."
Out the open door of the Kagan battle wagon, the radio crackled again. The voices of the men they were waiting for wavered as the set strained to pick up and decode the scrambled channel.
There was a sudden increase in volume and clarity as the Shawn team cleared some geographic obstacle in among the rising land behind the bridge. Mitsui Jones straightened up.
"Better get in position, Matt. Feels like showtime."
Mike Bryant saw the intersection bridge up ahead as they cleared the last spur and let a fraction of his speed bleed off.
"Watch the bridge," he said easily. "Watch your peripherals till we're past. Keep it tight."
On the north side ramp, Mitsui Jones heard him and grinned as she slipped her driving glasses on. In the rearview mirror, she saw Matt settle into a firing stance with the vicar's cat. She let off the parking brake and the Mitsubishi shifted on the hard shoulder. The missile leapt out, trailing a thin vapor thread as it went. As they hit the bridge, Bryant saw it. Through the windshield, a column of greasy smoke lifted from the hills up ahead. A muffled crump rolled in to accompany the explosion.
"See that?" He braked a little more, puzzled. "They must be in trouble up ahead."
"I don't know, Mike." Chris's voice crashed into the cabin. "Trouble with who? Tender was all over the news this week. No one will be out here who doesn't have to be."
"Maybe one of those fancy Mitz fuel feeds blew up on them," suggested Makin.
"Could be." Chris's tone said he thought it was a stupid idea, but since they'd started the run, both he and Makin had shut down the bullshit.
"I still don't like it.
Go right! Right!"
The yell came too late. They were under the bridge and past the access ramp, and the sleek black shapes on the left came spilling directly down the grass slope like commandos breaching a wall defense. The lead Nakamura car hit the highway at reckless speed, bounced and slammed into Mike Bryant's BMW.
"Fuck!"
Bryant hauled on the wheel. Too slow. The second Nakamura vehicle scuttled through the gap behind him and came up on his right flank. There was a long, grating clang as the two Mitsubishi cruisers sandwiched him. Bryant caught a flash of a third vehicle, longer and lower, pulling ahead, and knew what was going to happen. He wrestled desperately with wheel and brakes, but the clinch was set. The Nakamura wingmen had him.
"Can you get these motherfuckers off me?"
Bryant tried for a nonchalant tone, but sweat was beading on his face. Every move he tried to break free was matched.
"They're going to head-to-head me."
A side impact jarred through Bryant.
"No fucking way," Chris yelled. "They're locked on tight, Mike. You've got a crash stop."
"Can't afford to lose the momentum, Chris, you know that."
"You can't afford to stay in there, Mike."
The crisp edge of control in Makin's tone made him sound almost prissy.
"Chris is white. Dwarf out, pick it up after."
"No fucking way."
Up ahead, the long, low Mitsubishi battle wagon whipped around on shrieking tires and came back up the highway toward the locked-up Shawn leader.
"Nick!"
Bryant's voice was strained.
"That's Jones up ahead. Get out there and see if you can't derail her."
"On it."
Makin's BMW flashed on the edge of Bryant's vision as it accelerated away from the three-vehicle clinch. Bryant blew out breath, hard and fast, and settled into his speed.
"What about me?"
"You hang back, Chris. This doesn't work. I'm going to need you."
Up ahead, he watched as Nick Makin drove hard at what had to be Mitsui Jones's vehicle. A hot note of hope pulsed through his guts in defiance of the icy knowing that told him Jones would not be stopped. The Nakamura team had set him up with consummate skill, and they'd left him with only two options. Slam stop and lose the dual inertia. In effect, drop out of the combat, admit Nakamura's tactical superiority, and have to drive catch-up for the next 200 kilometers. An image of Chris's chessboard flashed through his mind. Symbolic defeat. Or... The Mitsubishi flinched aside and left Makin stalled across the highway. Bryant grimaced and floored his accelerator. The two Nakamura vehicles matched it effortlessly. The battle wagon came on.
"Chris, this is going to be messy," he gritted. "Get yourself clear."
Seconds from the chicken head-to-head, the two Nakamura wingmen peeled away as if their vehicles were under the command of a single driver. Bryant caught a face grinning at him from the left-hand vehicle, and a hand lifted in farewell. Jones's car was almost on him. The radio crackled at him.
"Sayonara, Bryant-san."
Matsui Jones must have jerked the wheel at the last possible moment. Bryant misread it and stayed in line, but Jones had left the rear of the Mitsubishi in his path. The BMW hit at speed, and the front left wing of the car kicked into the air. Bryant yelled, incoherent with shock, as his vehicle left the road. The Omega turned lazily in the air and came down on its side, trailing a carpet of sparks across the asphalt. 3 seconds into the skid, it ploughed into the median. Jones heard the yell, but had no time for anything other than fighting her own vehicle back under control. The Mitsubishi whipped about on the impact and staggered sideways. For 3 seconds, the wheel was like a live thing under her hands, and then she had it back. She braked the cruiser toward a smoking halt, facing back the way she'd come. Bryant's BMW lay on one side, jammed into the median barrier and leaning jauntily. The vehicle's roof faced out, the windshield showing spiderweb cracking in the weak spring sunlight. Bryant was pinned in clear view, struggling with his belt. Jones snarled a grin and came off the brake, slamming in the gear as the cruiser freewheeled backward, accelerating hard against the inertial drag. The Kagan's engine shrilled, and the cruiser sprang forward. Trapped and twisted against his own seatbelt, Mike Bryant heard the sound and flailed about to look. By the time he had forced his head around far enough to see, the Mitsubishi was almost on him. He just had time to scream.
Ah, fuck!
And the cruiser was gone, jolted past, and there was a titanium-gray Saab crunched to its tail, two engines in savagely low gear roaring against each other, and the shriek of steel under stress.
Chris?
Chris's voice drifted into the upturned space, laconic.
Be right back.
Metal tore down one wing of the Nakamura car and ripped clear, exposing the driver's side rear wheel. Jones shrieked abuse in Japanese, her English abandoned in momentary fury. Chris was already past, yelling into his mic with sudden urgency.
"Macon, where are you?"
"Up ahead."
There was a tight edge of panic in the other man's voice.
"I've got both these motherfuckers on my tail. I think they're going to lock me up same as Mike."
"On my way."
Chris spotted the Nakamura wingmen a pair of seconds later, dancing spirals behind and alongside Macon's BMW. As he watched, the left-hand car slipped in and struck the Sean car a glancing blow. Macon jerked sideways and the other Mitsubishi rammed him from the rear. It was consummate teamwork, Chris had time to reflect briefly, something that the young guns at Sean could learn from and probably never would. Then he was on the left-hand car. He hit it at full acceleration and felt the impact down to the roots of his teeth.
"Right,"
he muttered. The Nakamura car tried to pull away but didn't have the power. Chris gave up a handbreadth of space, then floored the pedal and hit again. This time the wingman tried to skate sideways right. Chris matched the move. He gave up the handbreadth again, and when the Nakamura driver slewed to the left, he let him. He went with the move and forced it. Another jolt and he was jammed onto the rear fender, driving the other car toward the grass bank that lined the left-hand hard shoulder. It could have been better. Could, for example, have been the drop on the other side of the roadway, but it would have to do. Something flashed in his peripheral vision, the glossy black of the other Nakamura car. The other wingman was coming to his comrade's aid. Chris fought down the urge to let go and face the new threat. His voice went gritted into the mic.
"Macon, get rid of this fucker, will you?"
"Done."
The BMW was there, twilight blue jostling with the black for position. The two cars peeled away as the Nakamura driver fled. Chris turned his full attention back to killing the man in front of him. The rapid rumble as they crossed the reflector line of the hard shoulder, and the wingman finally panic-braked as he neared the bank. It was far too late. Chris hit the overdrive on the Saab's transmission and drove his opponent hard up the 50-degree incline. As soon as the other vehicle was fully off the road, he braked savagely and dropped back. Denied the power of the Saab pushing and subject to his own desperately applied brakes, the wingman slithered back down the grass, hit the road surface with an overload of kinetic energy to shed, and tumbled across the three lanes into the crash barrier. The Mitsubishi exploded.
"Bonus,"
Chris said to nobody in particular, and threw the Saab into a U-turn crash stop. A kilometer back along the highway, he saw what he'd been expecting. Mitsuo Jones's battle wagon heading directly for him, trailing wreckage from one wing like a shark with seized prey in its jaws. Chris engaged the Saab's launch gear. The rear wheels squealed on the road, scrabbled for purchase, and found it. The Saab leapt forward. Past the egg-yolk yellow and billowing black smoke of the crashed and burned wingman, back down the slope toward the bridge where the duel had kicked in. The hungry roar of the engine seemed to recede as he plunged back toward the Nakamura car. He had time to notice the marred lines of the other vehicle as it ballooned in his windshield, time to notice the pewter cloud formations smeared across the sky behind, time even to see the gusting wind blowing the grass flat along the embankment to his right. At the last possible moment, Jones flinched left, covering the torn wing damage as he guessed she would. He ploughed into her right-hand rear side with brutal precision. The Saab's spaced armoring held and opened a huge gap over the Mitsubishi's rear tire. Chris hit the brakes, and at the relatively low speed he'd developed, the U-turn came comfortably. He was back on Jones's tail before she'd made 500 meters of road away from him. The Mitsubishi was crippled, limping at barely 100. He matched speeds and glanced across at the other car. Polarized glass hid Jones from view. Finish it. He slewed sideways, caught the exposed rear tire on the leading edge of his front fender, and braked. Textbook maneuver. The tire ripped and exploded with a muffled bang. He felt the front fender unstitch along half its length with the force of the impact, but the rest held. Yes, Carly, you fucking beauty! The Kagan jerked and began to skid. Chris worked his pedals, gunned the engine, and rammed into the rear of the Mitsubishi as it floated past ahead of him. The skid built. The car wallowed on the road, and Chris steered back across and around. Another sharp jab at the retreating side of the car. The driver's side door dented inward, and Mitsui Jones was irretrievable. The Nakamura battle wagon skated a figure eight in toward the bank and hit with an audible crump. Chris brought the Saab to a screeching halt, breaking clouds of rubber smoke off the asphalt as he slid past Jones's wreck. A 360 sweep showed no other vehicles in either direction. He engaged the reverse and backed up gingerly to check on his handiwork.
Chris?
It was Bryant's voice, distorted over the comm set.
Yeah, Mike, I'm here.
The strange calm was back, the sky and wind-swept landscape pressing down on his consciousness like a thumb on an eyeball. He gave the status report through lips that felt slightly numb.
One wingman down, flamed out. Think Makin got the other. You okay?
I will be as soon as someone comes and cuts me out of this fucking wreck. What about Jones?
He glared at the ruined battle wagon. The sleek bodywork was torn and crumpled, sunk on tires that had blown out somewhere in the crash. Steam curled up from the gashed radiator grill like smoke was whipped away by the wind. And in amid all that calm, it looked as if Jones was trying to kick the driver's side door open. The buckled metal quivered, but didn't shift.
Finish it.
Jones is out of the game, he said. Mike's whoop came through, bristling with static and overload distortion. Chris dropped his hand to grasp the gear lever, and with the motion a small ripple arose in the pit of his stomach. It was nothing much, the feeling of having eaten too much sweet food. But as his hand touched the lever, he was suddenly slightly sick of the whole thing.
Then finish it!
Burn her up. The thought belched abruptly up from the deepest mud geyser recesses of his being, and it gripped him like claws. It was the sickness of the moment before turned up to full. The edgy thrill of roller coaster exhilaration as he turned the sticky new idea over in his mind. Ram the tank and barbecue that bitch. Go on. If it doesn't blow when it ruptures, you can go and light her from close up. Like... He shook himself free of it with a shiver. Impossible to believe he'd even been considering it. After all, what if the tank blew when he hit? They almost never do.
Too risky,
he heard himself talking out loud to the hot mud thing in his head, and what he heard sounded too much like whining. He grimaced and dropped the car into reverse again. Much better just to... He backed up another 20 meters, aligned the nose of the Saab, and then crushed the accelerator smoothly to the floor. The Saab leapt across the short gap and slammed into the driver's side door. Metal crunched, and the Mitsubishi rocked on its springs. The glass in the side window cracked and splintered. He backed up and watched carefully to see if there was any movement.
Do it again. Finish it.
She is finished. Hewitt, with a Nemex in her hand. You bring back their plastic. He heard his own voice in the Shawn conference room 2 months ago. Nobody likes ambiguity. Yeah, and this is real fucking ambiguous, Chris. So either you go for the burn, or you take that pistol in your pocket and go and recover Jones's fucking plastic right now.
Chris, are you okay?
Bryant, sounding concerned. His voice ruptured the ominous quiet on the comlink, and every second that Chris left without replying was a stillness that prickled. Yeah, I'm fine. He unlatched the door and pushed it open. The Nemex had already somehow found its way into his hand. Be right back. He climbed out and advanced cautiously toward the Mitsubishi, gun hand extended and trembling slightly. Steam was still boiling from the engine space, hissing as it went, but there was no scent of gas. The car's fuel system, classic weakness in most Mitsubishi battle wagons, had apparently not ruptured. Chris stopped less than a meter away from the smashed glass of the polarized window and peered in over the sight of the Nemex. Mitsui Jones lay, still strapped into the driver's seat, face blooded and right arm hanging slackly at her side. She was still conscious, and as Chris's pale shadow fell across the car window, she looked up. Blood had run into her right eye and gummed it shut, but the other eye was desperately expressive. Her left hand came up, and across her trapped body, in a futile warding gesture.
"Finish it!"
Chris shielded his face with one hand and leveled the Nemex on Jones's face.
"Nobody likes ambiguity."
The shot echoed out flatly across the pewter-smeared sky. The blood splattered warm on his fingers. Chapter 13.
"Would you say that this tender was excessively bloody?"
Chris's face felt stretched tight under the makeup. Studio lights made his eyes ache with glare. Beside him, Bryant betrayed no discomfort as he tilted his head back at an angle and swiveled slightly on his chair.
"That's a tricky question, Liz."
He paused. Pure theatrical bullshit. The bloodshed question was a staple of all business news post-tender interviews. Bryant had had nearly a full day to think about his answer. Liz Linshaw waited. She crossed long, tanned legs and readjusted the data-down clipboard on her short-skirted lap. From where he was sitting slightly to the left of Bryant's center stage, Chris could see liquid crystal sentences spilling down the clipboard screen. Her next set of cues from the studio control room. From where he was sitting, he could also see the swell Liz Linshaw's left breast made where it squeezed up in the open neck of her blouse. He shifted his gaze uncomfortably, just as Bryant launched into his answer.
"The thing is, Liz, any competitive tender is bound to involve a certain degree of conflict. If it didn't, then the whole market ethos of what we're doing here would be lost. And in the case of a tender of this magnitude, obviously the parties involved are going to play hard. That, sadly, but necessarily, means bloodshed. But that's exactly the way it should be."
Liz Linshaw made out that she was taken aback.
"There should be bloodshed? You're saying that it's desirable?"
"Desirable, no."
Bryant put on a schoolmasterly smile that looked notly derived. Beside him, Louise Hewitt nodded sober agreement.
"But consider, the situation in Cambodia is extreme. These people are not part of some theoretical economic model. They are involved in a life-and-death struggle to determine the future of their nation. At Shawn, we've just been appointed their financiers. We are supposed to fund and advise these people, and, I might add, take a fair chunk of their GNP as a fee. Now, if you were a Cambodian, what kind of exec would you want? A suited, theoretical economist with computer models he says define their reality half a world away? Or a warrior who has put his own life on the line to earn his place beside them?"
"You call yourself a warrior?"
Linshaw made an elegant gesture that might have been acceptance. "And obviously the fact that it's your team here at the Tebbit Center this evening proves your credentials in that department." "All right. But does that necessarily make you the best economist for the job? Does a good economist have to have blood on his hands?"
"I'd say a practicing free market economist has blood on his hands, or he isn't doing his job properly. It comes with a market, and the decisions it demands, hard decisions, decisions of life and death. We have to make those decisions, and we have to get them right. We have to be determined to get them right. The blood on our hands today is the blood of our less determined colleagues, and that says something. To you, Liz, to our audience, and most of all to our Cambodian clients, that blood says that when the hard decisions come, we will not flinch from them."
"How do you feel about that, Chris?"
Liz Linshaw swiveled abruptly to face him.
"You eliminated Mitsui Jones today. What do you think the Nakamura team lacked that gave you the edge?"
Chris blinked. He'd been drifting.
"I think, they were very polished, but..."
He scrambled after the answer they'd worked out earlier when they ran the question checklist with the program's producer.
"But, there didn't seem to be much flexibility of response in the way they played as a team. Once they'd sprung the trap and it failed, they were sluggish."
"Was this the first time you'd driven against Nakamura, Chris?"
"Yes. Well, apart from a few informal skirmishes, yes." Chris got his act together. "I drove against Nakamura Junior execs in two consortium bids when I was working at Hammett McColl, but it's not the same. In a consortium bid, people tend to get in each other's way a lot. They usually haven't had a lot of time to train. It's easy to break team wedges. This was a whole different engine."
"Yes." She smiled brilliantly at him. "Was there any point where you were afraid Sean were going to lose to Nakamura?"
Hewitt sat forward, bristling.
"I don't think we ever came that close," said Bryant.
"Yes, but you were trapped in wreckage for most of the duel, Michael."
There was just a hint of acid in Linshaw's voice.
"Chris, you were the one who actually took Jones down. Was there ever a critical point?"
Chris glanced across at Bryant, who was wearing a rather thin smile. The big man's shoulders lifted in the barest of shrugs. Beyond him, Hewitt showed as much emotion as a block of granite.
"I think the missile ploy caught us the way it was intended to, and the jury's still out on whether that was a legal maneuver or not. But after Nakamura actually engaged, we were never really up against it."
"I see." Liz Linshaw leaned forward. "This is a great moment for you, isn't it, Chris? The hero of the hour, and coming so soon after your transfer, you must be over the moon."
Yes, he shrugged. "It's my job."
"A job you enjoy?"
Mindful of Hewitt's gaze, Chris manufactured a smile.
"I wouldn't be in this line of work if I didn't like it, Liz."
"Of course."
Linshaw seemed to have gotten what she wanted. She turned her attention to Hewitt.
"Now, Louise, you made all this happen. How do you feel about the way your team performed?"
Chris switched off again as Hewitt began to mouth the viewer consumable platitudes.
"What was that all about?"
He asked Bryant the question later as they sat in front of whiskey tumblers in the hotel bar of the Tebbit Center. Outside, wind-driven rain lashed impotently at big glass panels that gave a view out onto drenched and darkened hills. Makin had begged off early, pleading tomorrow's crack-of-dawn start. It was pretty obvious he was choked about Chris's guest spot on the Liz Linshaw.